CEO. My name is Tafel Valadas. I have been lecturing the politics and English for the last 10 days. But now we have a special guest. His name is Holmes Danavir Goswami, who is also a doctor in Vedanta philosophy and also doctor administration. And he's also directing Small Vedic University in USA. So Maharaj has been lecturing in different... This is the second time in Finland. The time before, he was visiting in Jyväskylä University, also Tampere and Helsinki. And now it happened that we had our festival program yesterday. We invited him, and now he was also with his opportunity to come here. And the title is called Education in Vedic India. So I think we'd just like to welcome Maharaj.
Thank you. Vedic, the whole system of Vedic education is geared towards understanding the self, understanding not just this phenomenal world, but ultimately coming to the understanding of the nature of one's existence and attaining the highest perfection that an individual can achieve, which is not simply limited to this lifetime. Therefore, you'll find Vedic education from the very beginning, there will be taught about the eternality of the self, the nature of the individual as being different from matter. Matter and spirit. You could say Bhagavad Gita describes that knowledge means to understand what is matter, what is spirit, and who's the controller of both. Well, Vedic education is geared towards that. Now, within the scope of Vedic education, there are many subtopics. They're called Jada Vidya, or knowledge of the material workings too, because it has its place. For example, there is a department of Vedic knowledge that deals with astronomy and astrology, Jyotirshastra. And there is a department that deals with morality and principles of occupation, Dharmashastra. And there is a department that deals with military sciences, Dhanurveda. And then there's the department that deals with the medical side, Ayurveda. There are many different branches of Vedic knowledge. However, they're all linked to this spiritual consideration. And the spiritual science is considered to be the highest science in Vedic education. Everything else is simply to bring one to that platform. For example, there are four primary aims or goals in Vedic culture. Dharma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha. So Dharma means religion, or more accurately, one's occupational duty, Dharma. Everyone is supposed to follow their occupational duty and their religious duty. And why do they do that? There's often a motivation that one will do that, and by doing, following that duty, dharma artha, then he gets economic development. Gets some money. And with money or economic development, one can karma, enjoy the senses, fulfill his desires. Dharma, artha, kama, and then the fourth is moksha, or salvation, liberation, to get out of the material situation. So the whole point is to bring one from a position of ignorance. For example, when a child comes out into the world, out of the womb, he's ignorant. He, even though the Vedas accept that this is not his first time around, this is not, he's not just been created, he's not a product of matter, so he's existed before, he's had many lifetimes before this one. But still, for the most part, he's ignorant of his real self. And therefore, the human form of life is meant to educate him further. When I say ignorant, it may not be exactly accurate, because according to his past activities, he's received a particular body. Shuchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Brashta Vijayate. So one who has achieved the human form of life has he's already gone through many other chapters of material existence. So he's supposed to be ready for higher knowledge, just as in order to enter this college one has to go through high school and junior school and primary school. It's not that one goes immediately to the college or the university. Human form of life then is a more graduated stage where one is supposed to be ready for receiving the highest type of education. The other types of education we see in the lower species, say animals and birds, insects, they're also skilled in how to fulfill their aims. They're skilled in how to eat and how to sleep. For example, how is it that the birds know to make their nest up in the trees? They have a kind of instinct. We say instinct. That's a word that's popularly used. But what is instinct? Instinct means some incredible, mystical, almost revelation to them within, that they know that this is for their best interest. This will protect them by making their nests up in the... They don't just lie... A dog, he just lies down. He knows, I can lie down in the street, it's all right. But a bird, if he just takes his rest at night in the on the ground, he'll be killed by his predators. So, there is a certain type of innate education which guides all the different species. Each species knows what to eat, for example, and where to find it. It's quite miraculous. For example, a little baby kitten, cat, soon as, even before its eyes are open, it starts looking for the mother's breastly nipple to drink milk. Now, who told the kitten that there was going to be milk somewhere? And who told the kitten that there was that he had to suck for it? We may say nature, nature has endowed that creature with that knowledge. The baby bird may be born in the same house or the same area as the little kitten, but the baby bird doesn't go looking for milk from the mother. Baby bird knows that, no, I'm not going to get milk, and I have to just keep my mouth open and make some chirping sounds, and my mother will feed it in that way. So, there's this type of knowledge which is available to the lower species, how to maintain their existence. But their level of education or knowledge stops at the point of understanding higher principles of spiritual understanding. You can teach a monkey how to ride a bike and how to do different things, but you can't teach a monkey about his spiritual nature to understand where he came from, who he is, things like that. Therefore, human education is distinct from all the other species. In that, for example, the Vedanta Sutra. The Vedanta Sutra is the codes of all Vedic knowledge is put into a very concise codes called the Sutra. Sutra means a very eloquent yet brief description, like a code. So the first statement is Atato Brahma Jigyasa. And the word Ata means now, but the implication is now that you've reached the human form of life. You're reading this, you're studying, that means you're human. Now that you've reached the human form of life, your business is one. Brahma Jigyasa. Brahma means the spirit, the spiritual nature. And jigyasa means inquiry. You're supposed to inquire about the spirit. That is human education. Other types of training. First of all, I should briefly explain that in the Vedic system of society, there are four divisions. You may know this, the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. So the Brahmanas are the intellectuals and spiritual leaders, the teachers. That's one group. The next group are the Kshatriyas, and they're the administrators and warriors. They're supposed to give protection and direction in terms of organizing the society. Then there are the Vaishyas, who are the productive class. They produce the food, the agriculture, and the mercantile activities, business. And the fourth group is called the Shudras, who are the laborers. They assist the other three. These four are compared to the parts of the body, our body. For example, the head is compared to the Brahmana, as you would expect, because the intellectual and spiritual, the intellect is situated here. We have senses for acquiring knowledge, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the ears. This is the way we acquire knowledge in the society. And no other parts of the body can fulfill that role. Then, the next group, what parts of the body would you suspect correspond to the Kshatriyas? Okay, the Kshatriyas were, who remembers? What would you say, the next?
Gloria.
Yeah, so what part of the body?
Oh.
Yeah, the army, right. The army. Arms. They protect. The arms are... Now the arms can't do the work of the head. And the head can't do the work of the arm. Well, it can do a little bit, but not so good. So, arms, head, then the next part, the next group are the Vaishyas, the productive class, that is compared to the belly. Because You need food. The food has to keep everything going. And if there's no food, then this body won't work. And similarly, if you don't produce food grains, then society, then the whole society won't work. Annat bhavati bhutani. So anna in Sanskrit means food grains. All living beings subsist on food grains. So the belly, have to keep the belly working properly. If there's improper digestion, then it causes disease in the body. So they have to keep the belly. Then the last group, the laborers, are compared to the legs. They carry the rest of the body. So they're doing also important work. Even though we may say, well, the legs are not as intelligent as the head. That's a fact. And it's true that if you were being attacked, you'd rather have the attack on the legs than on your head. You would protect your head first. Still, the legs are important. So in this way, the whole body taken together has its cooperative value. This is how the body works. And similarly, this is how society is supposed to work. Each group takes pride, not an undue pride, but a natural, humble pride in doing their duty for the whole. And, well, what is the aim of the whole? That's an important point, because education depends on what is the aim of society. Just like we know there are some societies that are interested in, let's say, developing military strength. So their education is geared towards that. They gear their students to that particular area so they can produce more sophisticated weaponry, etc. So it depends on what society considers to be the goal of our human existence, or the goal of our experience here. And the Vedic culture, as I mentioned earlier, considers the goal is mukti, or liberation. In other words, the goal is not to stay here. The goal is to get out. The goal is not to make a permanent settlement here. Whereas we see that modern education doesn't always stress that. Generally, modern education stresses, no, make yourself comfortable. Try to get a good situation here and enjoy this life. With the addition of, you should live a good life also so that afterwards you can go to heaven. And so that also parallels the Vedic idea. But it seems that there's more stress on the immediate type of enjoyment in modern day society than in the Vedic culture. Now, we can't use India today exactly as the model for the Vedic culture, although there still are some remnants of that Vedic culture visible if one goes to India, especially if one goes to the villages or to places that are very holy and sacred. You'll find more of the Vedic culture intact. But modern India has decided to follow the Western idea as its goal in life, which is not Vedic. So, when we're speaking of Vedic, we're referring to that which is, Veda means knowledge in Sanskrit, and the Vedic system is based on the Vedic scriptures, which are an eternal body of knowledge, very vast body of knowledge, which was written down on paper, or at that time leaf paper, 5,000 years ago. Before that, there was no need for that knowledge to be written down, because it was passed on by hearing. That's called Shruti. Therefore, another name for Vedic knowledge is Shruti, that which is heard. And that's why you won't find any books anywhere on the planet that are older than 5,000 years. Because before that, people didn't write things down. Why? Because it was a previous age. There are four ages that continually rotate, similar to the four seasons that continually rotate. The four ages, the first age is called Satya Yuga. Yuga means age. And it is the best of ages. It's the longest age. The people in that age are all saintly. They don't even have impure inclinations. They're so saintly that it's practically like living in the spiritual world. It's so nice. Everyone gets along. There's no quarreling. And people live a very long time. Because of their purity and their piety and the whole influence of the age, the lifespan is 100,000 years. Humans live 100,000 years. That's why we find in the Vedic literatures, or the scriptures, that there are yogis meditating for thousands and thousands of years. They're sitting down in a trance, samadhi, and they're meditating for thousands of years. And it's not that the Vedas don't understand our system of time. They do. As a matter of fact, the system of time described in the Vedas is extremely elaborate. It begins with the amount of time. They calculate time from the atom. The Vedic scriptures describe the atom, Anu, and the amount of time that it takes for the sun to pass over one atom. That's the smallest category of time. And then it goes all the way up. That there are different levels of time, going all the way up to the Parada, or the lifetime of Brahma. And the lifetime of Brahma, who happens to be the superintendent or the engineer of the particular universe, is calculated to equal the amount of time it takes Vishnu to exhale. The exhalation, one exhalation of Vishnu, because he's so vast, takes 311 trillion earth years. So you can see that there's a vast span of time from the tiny 100,000th of a second up to 311 trillion years, equaling the lifetime of Brahma. And we're somewhere, our lifetime is smaller, somewhere in the category there. Let's see, why was I discussing the time?
The four ages.
Thank you. The four ages. So the time, 100,000 years, the next age, the lifespan is reduced to 10,000 years because vice is introduced. The next age, which is the one previous to this one, is called Dvapara Yuga. The lifespan starts off at 1,000 years, but diminishes down to about 100 by the end of the age. So that age ended 5,100 years ago. But people still in that age were endowed with memories sufficient for remembering when they hear something. They didn't need to write things down. They had, it's like we have tape recorders to record things. Their memories were able to record them and remember them. Therefore, there was no books written down before that. In those days, the teacher would simply speak. Teacher in Sanskrit is generally called guru. Guru means teacher, especially a saintly teacher, but there's no need to say saintly because in Vedic culture a teacher must be saintly. If he's not saintly, he can't be a teacher. It's not allowed. Because to be a brahmana or to be a teacher or a guru, one must follow a very regulated and spiritually oriented lifestyle. If he lives a wild lifestyle, then he can't be a teacher. He has to be one of the other three. He has to be either a Kshatriya or a Vaishya or a Shudra, but he cannot be a Brahmin. Because they were very strict about that, because they considered that the teachers, being the head of society, giving the direction, have to be sober. Dhira. The word for sober is dhira. They have to be. If your head is intoxicated, then everyone knows they don't like people to drive when their head's intoxicated, because it causes danger. Because when the head is intoxicated, it starts seeing things and swaying, and it's very easy to miscalculate. So it's a very dangerous situation. Similarly, the brahmanas, the intellectuals or spiritual heads, have to be sober and saintly. So that word is guru. So the guru would teach his students. Students are called shisha. Shisha means students. And the process of education is called siksha, or giving knowledge. So he would simply speak, and the students would hear, and they would remember. We find that connected with that system of education was the importance of brahmacharya, or celibacy. In the Vedas, the emphasis is put on celibacy, because by celibacy, one is taught to raise the semina, which is a very important substance, but to raise it to the brain by not expelling it. And by doing that, it nourishes the brain. And therefore we find that those who were celibate totally throughout their whole lives, never wasting any of their semina, were also endowed with perfect memory. They could, even as recently as maybe 60 or 70 years ago, there was a case in India where there was a discussion between two persons, and they were having an argument, and later it was brought to court about what one person said and what the other, and they were trying to find witnesses. They found one celibate, saintly person. He didn't speak the language that the two persons were talking in, but when the judge somehow or other related to him that they wanted to know what was spoken, he was able to repeat what was spoken, even though he wasn't familiar with that particular language, just because of his memory being so sharp. So there's a connection between one's lifestyle and one's ability to memorize things, and even more important, the ability to understand things, especially higher things. When we speak of spiritual education, it's not available just for persons who have meager intelligence. For example, there's two words in Sanskrit. One is called Alpamedasaha, and the other is called Sumedasaha. So Alpamedasaha means very meager intelligence, not very much brain substance. And Sumedasaha means he has very good brain substance. And that brain, or the ability to realize spiritual wisdom, is not simply a material function. Actually, it's a function of the spirit. Because by nature, the individual spirit, when I speak of spirit, soul, the Atma, the self, I'm referring to the non-material particle that is giving life to this body, shall we say. And I'm referring to the particle that when it leaves the body is a dead corpse. What is it that makes a living person a corpse? Just one second. Just that living spiritual particle leaves, and it's a dead corpse, and no one, just throw it out, burn it. But a few minutes before, we would spend any amount of money to try to give it protection and give it a cure or something like that. So what is that valuable, most valuable ingredient? Not the body, and it's not the mind, and it's not the intelligence, and it's not the ego, but it's the soul, or the Atma, the self. So that self, that spiritual being, because of his being of the same nature as the supreme spiritual being, he also is endowed with the same qualities. And those qualities are three. Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat means eternality. Chit means knowledge. And Ananda means bliss. These are the intrinsic qualities of every living being. So when we speak of knowledge, it's not that he's lacking knowledge. He has the knowledge, but somehow or other, he's forgotten it. It's like amnesia. Everyone know what amnesia is? When someone gets hit on the head, and then they wake up, they look around. Where am I? What is... And their brother comes and says, "Don't you remember me?" Blank. "Don't you know who you are?" Blank. "Don't you know where this is? This is your home?" Blank. Nothing. He's cleared. You know, like when you have a calculator and you're calculating, you push the clear button? Clear. So he's just cleared. He's forgotten his... So we are like that. Human beings, generally speaking, have taken a serious blow coming into this material world, and they've forgotten their true identity. They don't know who they are, or where they are, or what they're doing here. Why am I here? How did I get here? So they're supposed to be educated. And that's the education of the Vedas, to explain to this forgotten soul who you are, why, how you got here. For example, the Vedas say, how did we get here? Krishna Bhaya Mukahana Bhogavan Chakari Nikatastha Mayatari Japatiyadari. When one becomes inimical towards the Supreme, then he's slapped down into the material realm. And that slapping, that coming, that initial coming into this material world, causes one to be overcome by ignorance, forgetfulness, that amnesia. Now, how do they bring about a cure for an amnesia patient? Well, they keep trying to bring before the patient things that remind him of his true identity. And they keep speaking to him, reminding him, talking about it. They try to get him to remember again. And it works. After some time, he begins to remember. In the same way, the Vedic education is to help the human to remember his spiritual position and his relationship with Krishna. Also, Vedic education is designed to help one remember his relationship with Krishna or the Supreme Being. Because how can you have education without that part? Of course, we're trying to do that now in modern days. But it's not a complete education. Because we all are trying to find the source. For example, modern science. They are very interested in trying to find out the origin of life, the origin of the universe. Now, without the understanding that there is a supreme conscious being that's the source of everything, then we have to look and try to find some other source. So the Vedas start off right from the beginning and say, no, the source of everything is the supreme being, Krishna. And this is, it's confirmed by great authorities such as Brahma, Lord Brahma is considered to be the greatest authority on Vedic knowledge because he's the first created being. And he taught Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadi Radya Govinda Sarva Karna Karna. The cause of all causes is this Govinda or Krishna. So that saves a lot of time. Instead of having to spend our whole life and maybe many lives trying to investigate what is the first cause, the original cause, Vedas explain that the original cause is Krishna. So another aspect of Vedic education is, as you can see, it doesn't depend on research or discovery, but it depends more on knowledge coming down, the deductive process, rather than the inductive process. In other words, by hearing from higher authorities, this is how we gain knowledge. For example, let's say we hear a sound on the top of from above. We all hear the same sound. And we say, well, what do you think that was? Well, everyone may give their own opinion. I think it was a squirrel. No, I think someone threw a rock. No, I think that it was a big snowflake. And someone else says, no, I think it was... We can all speculate what it was. But if someone up above who's there and sees it, and if we ask him, what was it? He says, oh, I dropped my screwdriver. Oh, man. Then it makes it so much easier than speculating. Things that are beyond our experience, beyond our perception, cannot be speculated upon. So how can we understand things that were existing before our appearance? We have to find out from authorities who were present. We have to find out from authorities who have greater knowledge than we. How do we learn how to do something? If someone just gave you a computer for the first time without any introduction, a very sophisticated computer, and said, that's it, how would you figure it out? It might, if you had no idea what it was and how to work it. So similarly, the workings of the material energy and the spiritual energy are quite complex. And they're beyond the capacity of an ordinary brain to fathom simply by his own ability. In other words, the highest education is not obtained simply with the brain. The highest education is obtained on the spiritual platform. But this is a whole new approach, or shall we say it's a whole different approach than other types of education, which are mostly a function of the senses. The senses acquiring information and somehow or other evaluating and coming up with a certain understanding. But this spiritual knowledge or education cannot be understood simply on the material platform. So then what's the other ingredient then that will make it possible to understand spiritual education or Vedic education? It's a thing called bhakti. Bhakti. I don't know if I should be spelling these things on the board or anything. Should I? Bhakti. This ingredient is required for any student in the Vedic society. And what does bhakti mean? It means that one is supposed to engage in devotional activities towards the Supreme, towards the Divine. And by doing that, then this transcendental realization will be bestowed upon him from above. In other words, it can't be acquired simply by scholarship. There's a verse. Vede shudur labam adur labam atma bhakto. So, Veda means one may go on trying to acquire knowledge by scholarship, reading, studying, reading, but that's not sufficient. Atma bhakto, without bhakti, it's stated he can go on like that for millions of lifetimes and he won't be able to understand. This spiritual knowledge is a very, very confidential thing that is bestowed by higher authorities. Similar in our own educational system. For example, let's say a teacher is trying to teach the students and there's one student who's very rebellious. I don't want to hear from you. Puts fingers, you know, sitting in the class, throwing stones at the teacher. So this is not a very good qualification for learning. The teacher will not bestow his or her kindness or blessings upon the student, because that educational process is between student and teacher is a very intimate relationship. It's sometimes compared to the sowing of a seed. The seed has to be potent, and the earth that it's sowed into has to be fertile. So the student has to be fertile, and the teacher has to be potent. The teacher has to have real knowledge, and the student has to be fertile, has to be inquisitive, has to want to know. And that this bhakti is an essential feature of all transmission of Vedic knowledge. It will not be transmitted to anyone who doesn't have bhakti. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, if you want to understand the transcendence, bhakti amam abhijanati, you have to engage in bhakti. Not by scholarship alone can I be understood. So therefore, the whole system of education is based on bhakti. And the teacher has to simultaneously teach the student the intellectual aspects, as well as the devotional aspects as well. There's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam which describes Vedic education. Brahmachari Gurukule Samdanto Guruhitam. So the traditional Vedic educational system is called Gurukula. Guru means teacher and Kuru means place. So it's the house of the Guru or the house of the teacher. And often the teacher was a householder, Brahmana, had his wife. And so the young boys would go there at the age of 5. Komara Achare Pragyo Dharmam Bhagavataniha. Komara means the age of 5. So they would go there at 5 and they would study under the teacher. And he would teach them, for example, there are certain aspects of bhakti that one has to learn to respect different members of society and different things. So they're taught to respect the teacher, they're taught to respect Brahmanas, they're taught to respect the mother and the father, they're taught to respect the Vedas, they're taught to respect the demigods, and the ultimate respect they're taught to give to God or Krishna. So you can see that the Vedic education is combining the spiritual teachings with the understanding of the world. And that was quite prevalent all over the world until recently. That generally speaking, the priests, spiritual leaders, they were the teachers also. I know in Greece, I spent some time in Greece. So formerly the education was entrusted to the Greek priests, the fathers. They were educating the children. And that's all over the world, that's the system. So that's the Vedic system. Gradually, of course, we've gone away from that. But that's what the modern Krishna consciousness society is based on. Of course, as Tathagata mentioned, we've also started a modest, humble Vedic university in the United States, in Kansas City. And we're working on this Vedic principle. The teachers are trained brahmanas. They have to live a very spiritually oriented life. They have to be... and they educate the students along those lines. The brahmachari or celibacy is taught there. And the religious practice or the spiritual practices along with the other type of education. Now, different I'll just make one more point and then I'll ask if there's any questions. Because the four different divisions of society need different types of education. So the brahmanas, the first group, they would go for a long time to the school because they had to learn vast amount of wisdom. The kshatriyas, they received a certain basic type of knowledge, but then they went off and they learned also about the military skills, the administrative skills, etc. The vaishyas, they got some a little less. They got a basic information, and then they went into their particular field. And the Shudras, they didn't go to the universities at all, but they were just engaged in working, and that's still the case. Even in India now, a young child who's coming from a particular laborer's family, he'll generally be educated by his father or the relatives on how to perform that particular skill and that technology. So that is a kind of an overview of Vedic education. Maybe if there's any questions, we can. If there's anything you'd like clarified, or
so. How do you get to know which part you should?
Yes, that's a good point. That's described in Bhagavad Gita. Guna and karma. Chaturvarnam mayashrisham guna karma. Vibhagashaha. So the division, Vibhagashaha, is according to one's guna, means qualities. An individual has particular qualities. He's inclined in a particular way. Someone, for example, he's inclined towards, you know, chivalrous activities, very, you know, likes to fight, likes to control others. So that means you could see by his quality he's tending towards the kshatriya. He shows the qualities. So guna and karma. And if he's engaged in that way, then he can actually become a kshatriya. So the guru or the spiritual teacher would see what are the inclinations towards the students. And they would be guided. It's not according to birth. It's not that if one is born in a family of priests or intellectuals that automatically he will be given that status. No. Nor will he automatically be given that education. If he's inclined more for laborer's work, then he should be given that position. So the expert guru is one who can tell at a certain age and then give the training in that way.
What if you're born into a laborer's family and you don't get to have the education? And then you won't know if they're meant to be
involved. That's another good question.
Could we please hear the question?
No.
You said if they're born into a labor family, then they don't get the chance to have their education. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, then there would have to be some... Someone would have to notice that this child is inclined. And that happens in the Vedic culture. There are exceptions where, for example, there was one such boy. He was a young boy and he was inclined. So he went to a teacher. He wanted to go and study. So he went to the teacher and he said, "Please, teacher, teach me." And the father, the teacher said, well, you know, what's your family? What's your lineage? And he said, I don't know. So, well, what's your father? And he said, I don't know. So he said, go find out from your mother. So he went back and he asked his mother what, you know, what his father was. Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. Mother said, son, I'm sorry, I don't know. So he went back and he said, my mother said she doesn't know. We don't know. So the teacher said, all right, I accept you. You're a Brahman because you told the truth. Because satyam is one of the qualities of a Brahman. To be honest, to be truthful. So if one has those inclinations, he's inclined in that way, that will be ascertained. The parents also, they can see if their son is inclined. The parents are also gurus. They're the first guru. The first guru is the father. So he's supposed to educate his child too. It doesn't only start at 5 years. There's 5 years of time there. He's supposed to be educating his child too. And if he sees that, in fact, there's another, it's called samskara. At the time of when a child is 6 months old, there's a samskara or purificatory rite where the child is given the choice of scriptures or money. Sometimes other things are put there too. And his whichever choice, it's considered to be some type of an indication which direction he'll go. Although it's not always to be taken, but that's another type of indication. But the parents should see if their child is inclined in that way, then they can send him to school. But the idea is not to send laborers to school where they won't be happy. We've all seen people in young people in school who don't want to be in school. They'd be much happier if they were out, you know, doing some kind of work. You know, like cutting down trees or something that they might find more satisfying, taking care of animals and things like that. They'd be less apt to get into trouble. Other questions? Yes?
When you talk about teachers, you all the time refer to them with the word he. And talk about children and talk about sons. Could you discuss about women, women's education and culture?
Yes. Generally, the women did not go to the Gurukula, the girls. They would be trained at home by the family members. And the Vedic, mostly by the mother and grandmother, etc. Because the Vedic system, and you need to understand a little bit about the culture. The Vedic system of family was that when a son got married, he would continue to remain in his family's home. And he would bring his wife with him. So the family would just, extended family, would just get bigger and bigger. And that's how they did it. So the education would go on in that way. The women's education was primarily geared towards chastity and religiousness. That a woman was taught to be chaste to her husband as the primary training. Because, and of course, that chastity and that religiousness and other practices, how to cook and how to take care of the children, would be her main asset in raising the children, looking after the children, an important function, and satisfying her husband. And, of course, assisting him in his activities, his occupation, but primarily performing those household functions. And the system worked very well in the sense that the women were given complete protection. They were not allowed to mingle freely with others. So, and there was no divorce. The Vedic system doesn't allow for any divorce. Once married, it's for life. So that has a very positive psychological impact on especially a woman. She knows that I'm going to be protected throughout my life. There's no question of being, and it never happened. There was no, we don't find in the Vedic literatures instances of a husband leaving his wife. It's just, it wasn't allowed in the Vedic system. So, in that way, they were educated not in the formal sense. They may not have studied Sanskrit and studied all the scriptures, but of course they were educated through the family system in an informal way, through the mother, the grandmother, etc. So they also had, and through their husbands and fathers, etc. So in that way they would also receive the opportunity to become extremely learned in that way. And there are many examples in the Vedic literatures of women who became extremely learned. Now, the other thing is that if a woman were to marry a brahmana, then naturally she would have opportunities for more association with an educational aspect, just by dint of her husband's. For example, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he was a child, this was about 500 years ago. So, he was playing in an area where they threw rejected pots. Pots that were used for eating and cooking. And it was like a dump, kind of. So he was sitting there, and his mother said, "Oh, why are you sitting there? This place is dirty." And also, he was eating clay. Eating dirt. Sometimes children eat dirt. So he was eating some dirt. The mother said, "Why are you eating dirt, sitting in this dirty place?" And the son, he said, "Well, everything is Brahman." He said, "Everything is all one." He was propounding a philosophy like our atomic theory that everything is just made of atoms. So he was saying, "Everything is just atoms. So why are you making this discrimination between that which is to be eaten and that which is not to be? You're making all these discriminations. These are all just your concoction." So he was an intellectual little boy. But his mother, it's described in the scripture that she answered because she was the wife of a brahmana. She was also very learned. And so she answered very nicely. She defeated his argument of oneness by saying, "Yes, there's oneness, but there's also varieties within the oneness. And when we have something in the form of a pot, it carries water. And when it's just clay, it doesn't carry water." And so she was able to explain that. So the educational system was not as formal, but it was certainly available. Another point is that, as we mentioned earlier, the Vedic education does not depend solely on scholarship. It depends on bhakti. And the women were taught bhakti in profusion. In fact, many times we see that the women became more learned than the men because of their extra inclination towards bhakti or devotion. There's one classic example. I'll make this the last point. There was one group of extremely learned, educated brahmanas. And they were performing yajnas and sacrifice, chanting mantras. It so happened that Krishna was present at that time as a cowherd boy, and he sent his cowherd boyfriends there and said, "Please ask them if they'll give a little charity of some fruits. We're hungry." So they went to the brahmanas, and the brahmanas said, "No, can't you see? We're busy. We're studying. Don't interrupt us." But then Krishna said, "Now try their wives." So the boys went to the wives, and the wives immediately gave whatever they had, which indicated that they had actually understood the Vedas better than their husbands. The husbands were so caught up in the intricacies of scholarship and learning that they missed the point that Krishna was right there asking them for some fruit, and they couldn't. Krishna is the goal of the Vedas. So later on, the Brahmins themselves, they decried their own learning. They said, "To hell with all of our studies, to hell with all of our practices of austerities and all this. We couldn't even understand what the goal was. And our wives, who didn't study and didn't perform any of these things, they understood better." So that's a little course, we could go on and on describing more and more about the culture, the Vedic culture, but I think we'll have to suffice. Yeah. Thank you very much.